Support for this podcast comes from the Fletcher School of Global Affairs at Tufts University. To start your future as a global changemaker, you must have context across fields like international business, cybersecurity, energy policy, and more. Don't just study global affairs, shape them. Visit fletcher.tufts.edu. Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at mathworks.com.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Syria's five-year-old civil war has killed a 250,000 people, displaced 11 million, made a home for the Islamic State, flooded Europe with refugees, drawn in Russia, confounded the United States, set the Middle East, in many ways, on fire. Now there's a peace talk push in Geneva. Hopes could hardly be lower. But the exercise lights up the interests at work here and their cost. This hour, On Point, what we learn in the push to negotiate over the civil war in Syria. You can join us on air or online, where this conversation is always on. How will this war end? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. How bad is it? Well, here's John Kerry in Rome on Tuesday. Yesterday, Secretary of State, U.S. Secretary of State, calling the Syrian war a full-on catastrophe.
The situation on the ground for the Syrian people is unfathomable. We haven't seen a catastrophe like this since World War II.
Joining me first today from Beirut, just off the plane from Geneva, is Patrick McDonnell, Beirut Bureau Chief for the Los Angeles Times. Patrick McDonnell, welcome back to One Point. Thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
These talks in Geneva, are they underway or not? We've heard it announced that they were. We've heard participants say that they're not. Is this actually happening, Patrick?
Well, I mean, I think that question captures a lot of the ambiguity in Geneva because there's been the UN mediator has had preliminary talks with both sides, but both sides seem to insist that the real talks have not begun, and it certainly seems clear that nothing of substance had been discussed, at least by the time I left Geneva this morning.
Remind us of the powers that were brought to bear to frame up these talks. Who pushed for these, with what expectation, what's behind them?
Well, I think you had a major kind of convergence of interest between the United States and Russia, which are two major powers on opposite sides of the Syrian war. Just to remind people, obviously, the United States has been supporting forces that are trying to oust Syrian President Assad, and Russia is very much trying to help him. But you had a kind of a convergence of Russian and U.S. interest in the need for just a kind of a solution here and some resemblance of a return to stability to Syria. And I think there were several things that were pushing that, including the rise of the Islamic State and the migrant crisis in Europe.
Is the Assad government fully participating? Is it fully represented from the Assad side?
They have a pretty extensive negotiating team in Geneva, including the head of the their UN mission, Bashar al-Jafari, who's heading, as I said, a very large group there. But he complained yesterday that nothing had been done, that he wasn't even aware who the opposition delegates were. So he doesn't seem very happy with the course of events so far.
And what about the opposition? Who is in Geneva representing or not the opposition?
Well, the main opposition bloc is a group called the Head Negotiations Committee, which was formed in December in Saudi Arabia, and it's a mix of representatives of armed groups on the ground and political dissidents, Syrian political dissidents. But one of the key things is that basically formed and backed by Saudi Arabia, which very, very much is a power that wants to unseat Assad and change the government there. And the United States, by contrast, has kind of somewhat modulated its public stance in recent months and said, yes, we want Assad out, but he can stay around for some undetermined period of time. The opposition negotiating team on the ground in Geneva is very much with the kind of Assad must go as soon as possible point of view.
They have not even agreed to sit in the same room. That's part of the basic structure here, right? That if they can all assemble and if they can agree that the talks are on, they still won't be looking at each other eye to eye.
Yeah, from the beginning, they said these would be proximity talks, a couple of reasons. I mean, sometimes John Kerry said, you don't want people sitting around the table yelling at each other, staring at each other. But I mean, there's also another technical issue insofar as several constituent groups that are part of the opposition committee are regarded as terrorist organizations by the government in Damascus and also by Russia. There's a few groups called Jaysan Islam and Awad Sham, which are very, very powerful armed factions, Islamist armed factions on the ground in Syria. And it seems pretty clear Damascus does not want to be negotiating with them because it regards them as terrorist groups, which is why they really want to find out exactly who's on the other negotiating team. So, I mean, there's a number of reasons for those so-called proximity talks. So it's not that unusual in the history of diplomatic negotiations.
I'm seeing that while these are going on, and Russia, I guess, helped push for this to happen, but Russia is bombing very actively. Of course, they're supporting the Assad government, and there have been significant air attacks just in the last couple of days as Geneva was supposed to be getting off the ground. What kind of message does that send to Geneva, where negotiation is supposed to be the theme?
Well, again, the message that that sends depends on your point of view. The opposition views that as a very, very negative message indeed and has called for an end to those that Russian-backed defenses, particularly around the northern city of Aleppo, which is, has been under half opposition, half government control for the last 3 years or so. But the government's viewpoint is the war goes on. We haven't agreed to a ceasefire. A ceasefire is something that may be negotiated, but it hasn't been agreed to yet. So, the war goes on until there's some kind of a negotiated settlement. And as you know, the government has made major battlefield advances since September 30th when the Russians intervened with substantial air power on the government's behalf. So the tide of the war has turned substantially in the last 3-4 months.
Patrick, we're going to use this beginning or effort to begin the talks as an opportunity to look at the conflict in Syria. But for the talks themselves, and they're supposed to go on for 6 months, and ideally they were supposed to reach some kind of understanding of how things might go forward from there within 18 months, some sort of negotiated settlement. The headlines that I see, here's one, zero confidence, as though the talks are beginning, but almost maybe nobody believes that they can achieve the formal aim.
Well, it seems there's a lot of negativity about them, but at the same time, those of us have been following this war for years. It's been very devastating, and from a humanitarian standpoint, one has to hope there's some possibility of a settlement somewhere, and this is really the only game out there right now. It certainly started very slowly, but some of the diplomats behind the scenes are still somewhat hopeful that once the initial period of posturing and bravado kind of cools down, there is a possibility of some progress. This is certainly the most concerted diplomatic effort to end the war, which is now almost 5 years old.
Patrick McDonald, Beirut Bureau Chief for the Los Angeles Times, just back in Beirut from Geneva there. He's been covering the effort to get the peace talks off the ground. Patrick, thank you very much for being with us.
My pleasure.
Here's the first line from the Syrian ambassador to the UN, Bashar al-Jafari. He was in Geneva where they were trying to get talks off the ground, but had they begun, the UN said yes. He said no.
Ce que j'ai essayé de dire, c'est que les circonstances, côté formalité.
What I tried to say is that the formalities haven't finished yet. They haven't been prepared. We're still in the preparatory phase before the indirect talks officially begin.
Hasn't even begun. Who should participate? On Tuesday, Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov said that the participation of two Syrian rebel groups, Jaish al-Islam and Ahrar al-Sham, in the talks does not mean they're legitimate, does not mean the groups are not terrorist groups, interpreted here by Euronews.
Their participation on an individual basis in the delegation formed at the Riyadh meeting does not mean, and it is acknowledged by everyone, including our American colleagues as co-chairs of the Vienna process, does not mean any acknowledgement of Jaish al-Islam and Ahrar al-Sham as partners in the negotiations, he says.
Have we even begun? Who's here? Who's a terrorist? Who's not? It's a welter in Geneva, but behind it, big interests at play. We want to look at those. Joining us right now from Geneva, Noah Bonzi. He's senior Syria analyst for the International Crisis Group. Noah Bonzi, thank you very much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
And from Norman, Oklahoma, Joshua Landis joins us, associate professor, director of the Center for Middle East Studies at the University of Oklahoma, author of the Syria Comment blog. Joshua Landis, welcome back to On Point. Thank you for being here.
Thank you, Tom. Thanks for asking me on.
Noah, what are we to make of the fact that these are kind of happening, kind of not happening, maybe happening at all? Is this important, or is this a complete sideshow to the bloodbath on the ground?
Well, it certainly could be important, but the problems that Patrick was referring to and the generally negative atmosphere that you've accurately described are indicative of sort of some fundamental problems with the way this has been set up. And to summarize, while the this is based on U.S.-Russian partnership, right, as have previous efforts to negotiate an end to the conflict been. The U.S. is very enthusiastically pushing for these talks to move as quickly as possible. It's applied heavy pressure to the opposition to attend and to participate constructively. But it's much less clear that Russia on the other side is at all eager for these to go anywhere. And when we look at what's happening on the ground, it's easy to understand why. Since Russia has directly intervened militarily, the regime is gaining significant ground. That is continuing this week. Russia escalated very significantly alongside the regime in Aleppo yesterday. Russia seems to be pressing its advantage, seeking to further create additional facts on the ground that would give the regime and Moscow a better negotiating hand, time, as they view it, very much being on their side,
Joshua,
at least in the short run.
Joshua, it seemed that Russia cooperated in helping get the talks off the ground, at least as an idea. Was that sincere? Did Russia see an interest at some point? Do they still see an interest in negotiation?
Yes, I think they do. These talks are taking place on two different levels. On the one level that we're talking about now is the Syrian-Syrian talks. And I think everybody despairs of the different sides coming together in Syria. Both sides see the other as completely illegitimate and want to win this struggle and think they can win. But there's another side, which is the international side. The Syrian military forces on the ground are so weak and so poor today that they depend almost entirely on international support. So the sponsors have gathered in Geneva. That includes Saudi Arabia, Iran, Russia, United States. And the negotiation amongst them is really as important and perhaps more important than what's going on amongst the Syrians.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We are talking about the talks in Geneva launched to negotiate an end to Syria's civil war. Nobody seems to think they have much of a chance, but they're a good window through which to look at what is going on in Syria. Of course, a lot of what's going on there and in its orbit, just absolutely brutal. Here's the BBC's Rami Rahayem reporting from the site of two suicide bombings in Damascus on Sunday. Attacks on a popular street with fruit stands, a military headquarters, all near a very important Shiite shrine. 71 people killed.
You can still smell a very strange mixture, I think, perhaps of blood and fruit on the site of the explosion.
Blood and fruit. Many places, not even fruit. Here's Nick Payton, Walsh, reporter with CNN, talking about the malnourishment experienced of the people in Madaya, Syria, in January. Absolutely up against the edge of what is humanly tolerable.
This is Dr. Mohammed. He shows us Fawaz Saif Aldin, age 50. So malnourished, he can't cope with food, only drip feeds. Held here, almost a ghost, edging towards death.
Syrians eating grass, if they can find that. And, of course, the outflow we've all seen. Here's some of the latest. People drowning off the coast of Turkey earlier this week. Australia's Sky News' Jonathan Samuels.
It's believed dozens died just off the Turkish coast as they tried to get to the Greek island of Lesbos. More bodies are brought into shore by boat as distraught survivors look on.
More than 260,000 dead in 5 years of fighting there. All kinds of torture, imprisonment, the huge outflows of people really unsettling Europe and the whole region on edge. The whole world watching. Noah Bonzi is with us from Geneva, Switzerland, senior Syria analyst for the International Crisis Group. Joshua Landis is with us from the University of Oklahoma's Center for Middle East Studies. You can join us as well. Are you keeping track of the costs of this conflict, the 250,000 dead, the millions displaced, the rise of ISIS, the flooding of Europe with desperate refugees? Is there a point in talking when Russia is bombing, when nobody's willing to give? And is the U.S. dreaming to be pushing for some negotiated settlement out of these talks. How does this war end? Noah, Joshua, there's a lot we want to learn from you. We have callers as well. Amir is calling. Amir, you're on the air.
Yes.
Yes, you're on, Amir. What do you see here?
Yeah, I lived in Syria most of my childhood and when I was a teenager. My dad was a diplomat there, and I support the Assad regime. You know, so my point is basically is that when I was in Syria, Syria is a country just like Lebanon and to a large extent Egypt. It has large constituency of people who are secular, atheists. They align themselves with the West, France, more or less Russia. We were strong. We were people who used to go to the opera. We were people who used to go to theater, the high-class theater. We didn't like religion. And we didn't like Assad regime, but when the uprising happened, and then all the money goes to the Islamists, who were the French. And the Assad regime was supported by Russia, but we didn't have a choice. People like us didn't have money. My dad was from Sudan, basically. He was a second division diplomat in Syria. He worked with the Arab League. My mom, too. Now I'm in the United States. I'm in Boston.
Amir, we hear the lament for what's been lost. How does this end now? How should it end?
Difficult question, but just like I said, I don't see a choice, but major powers align together. I'm sorry to say that, but this should include the Syrian regime and Russia and the United States against, let's say the Islamic State. It's more complicated than that, but let's say the Islamic State against the Islamists, against Al-Qaeda. Many of these people in Geneva today, Zahran Alloush, I don't know the other two guys, they have in their senior management people from Al-Qaeda, period.
Amir, we've got it, and we see exactly what you're saying there. Noah Bonzi, what about Amir knows Syria, and he says if you're going to solve this, you're going to have to work with Assad. The U.S. has long said Assad must go. I don't know where that stands now, but work with Assad against all the Islamists who have come to dominate the opposition here, though they did not begin it. What do you say, Noah? What do you see?
Well, it does get to just how difficult it is to resolve this. I mean, I think there's no question that in any political solution, if there is to be one, I think there's broad agreement, even within the opposition, that you want to maintain as much of the state to include parts of the army and security forces in order to ensure some level of order moving forward, that needs to be a part of the resolution. The question is really the person of Bashar Assad and a couple others around him. What makes this more difficult and more complicated than your caller suggests is that there are so many people within the opposition who are not jihadis, who are not in any way linked to Al-Qaeda or Islamic State, who very violently oppose the Islamic State, who will simply keep fighting so long as Bashar is ruling them. And when you look at the level of human suffering and just how personal this violence has got in terms of bombs targeting hospitals and schools, dropped from government aircraft targeting hospitals and schools, in terms of people being starved to death in siege scenarios, you simply have too many people who are willing to keep fighting so long as this person is in power. I think the challenge is if you can unlock a resolution in which he can be ushered out, you'll find potential common ground for compromise on either side. But it is so difficult to find compromise on the person of Bashar Assad.
Are you saying keep the Assad regime, just usher out Assad? Would the opposition really accept that? He and a couple of others go and the rest of the power structure stays and that's fine after all this?
Well, it depends on how you define regime. But the sort of lowest common denominator on the opposition side is that Bashar and sort of his inner circle would need to go. At some point during a political transition. There's broad agreement that you want to maintain as much of the state as possible, though there would be differences on exactly how much of that state and how you maintain it. Really, we haven't even gotten to in-depth discussions of how that might be done because of how toxic the Bashar question is itself.
Joshua Landis, take us to Russia and Iran and their interests here. They're in it for what? Are they in it to keep Assad in power or something else? Could they live with the kind of scenario that Noah Bonzi describes where, in effect, the lower elements of the Assad regime would somehow come to an accommodation with some of the opposition? Would Iran and Russia roll with that, Joshua?
No, I don't think they would. You know, the Russians say that they're not wedded to Bashar, but they are. They do not want the terrorists in power. This is the language
who's
they
terrorist?
Use. The entire opposition, as far as the Russians. The Russians were very clear. Putin was very clear. When he came to the UN, he said there is one legitimate government, and that's the internationally recognized government of Bashar al-Assad. Everybody else and all the other insurgencies are terrorists, and that's international law, and anybody who supports them is supporting terrorists. So he was very clear what he was going to do in Syria. And from the Russian point of view, one of the major reasons that they have – tried to get these talks off the ground in Geneva is that they're trying to bring this to the international community and say you cannot select which members of the opposition you want to win because they're working together. And at the heart, Eish al-Fatah, the major opposition force in the north, is al-Qaeda. And you can't begin to sort of separate with tweezers which ones you want to have rule Syria. Russia is saying – we're going to win this for Assad. And they're daring, in a sense, the United States and Saudi Arabia to take them on. Now, President Obama said the moment the Russians invaded, stepped in on the side of Assad to destroy the opposition, Obama said, we're not going to fight a proxy war with Russia for Syria. In a sense, it's like the end of World War II with Poland. Mm. America just doesn't have the interest in it. The question then is, will Saudi Arabia do this? And when Saudi Arabia organized the Syrian opposition in Riyadh about a month or so before this present meeting, the Saudi foreign minister told the opposition there is a military solution to the Syrian problem if Assad refuses to go. And in a sense promised the Syrian opposition that both America and Saudi Arabia would back them. If they go to Geneva and it falls apart – and Assad refuses to go, and you can show that to the world, then we'll back you. The question today in Geneva in many ways is, were the Saudis bluffing or will they really back the opposition with advanced weapons and more money in order to take on the Russian-backed Assad troops? And that's in a sense what's being negotiated. And I think Obama is punting. He is going to draw out these talks really to the end of his administration because he doesn't want to get into a fight with Russia. And he's not sure, you know, in many ways he sees this like Afghanistan. And I think Obama thought it was a mistake for the United States and Reagan to support the Mujahideen in Afghanistan to take on the Russian occupation. In many ways, Obama probably sees this, let the Russians have Syria in the way we should have let the Russians have Afghanistan. And we shouldn't have taken them on because we got al-Qaeda, Taliban, Islamist forces winning, and we couldn't choose which one of the Islamists we wanted to win. And that's, in a sense, I think he sees this situation as analogous, that it's not America's war. We cannot solve this ethnic, sectarian, religious problem in Syria, and let's stay out of it. And that's really, I think, what Russia wants to capitalize on in Geneva.
Noah Bonzi, in Geneva, do you see that? Do you see the Obama administration at bottom prepared to give Syria to the Russians and Assad and with that, I guess, their Iranian partners? Or would the U.S. swing in to support a heavy intervention by Saudi Arabia, as Joshua Landis describes? And if the Saudis can do that, why haven't they done it already? Does the opposition really have the wherewithal to take advanced weapons and all the rest and take on Russia?
Well, on the question of what the Obama administration is aiming at, I more or less agree with Joshua. I think that there seems to be an element of stalling for time here. There are major decisions that I think the administration would rather not take. Moving towards Russia, further towards Russia, and sort of conceding on the Assad question would be quite a blow to their legacy, given what they've said previously on the Assad's future. But also, ramping things up would be very risky for the reasons Joshua lays out. I think there's two sort of points here to make. And one is, the idea of handing Syria to the Russians, whether or not that would be acceptable from the perspective of American interests is linked to the question of how much the United States fears rising jihadi power, the Islamic State, al-Qaeda affiliates, etc. The dream scenario for jihadi groups in Syria, or jihadis in general, already they've got Syria is the best recruiting tool they've ever had. And in a situation in which Bashar Assad is trying to hold parts of the country with help from Iranian and Hezbollah troops or who are sort of acting as occupiers with Russian air support, you know, that's what handing Syria to Russia looks like. That is an even greater boon for jihadi recruitment. That obviously, as jihadis gain power in this area, in a situation in which mainstream groups backed by the United States, Saudi Arabia, Turkey are losing power, more of their fighters will go towards jihadi groups. I think that's more or less agreed upon by most following this conflict. How much of a threat that presents to American interests is a separate question, and one that maybe hasn't been fully answered as we sort of calculate the mid and long-term costs of this war.
Josh, I want to bring that to you. Caller first, Omaha, Nebraska. Dylan is calling. Hi, Dylan. You're on the air.
Yeah, hi, Tom. Thanks for fielding my comment.
Yes.
My real question / comment is I hear a lot of talk about how this conflict's going to be ended, but what about the long term? I mean, when you look in, I was a military Middle Eastern analyst for 5 years.
Yep.
And I focused a lot in Afghanistan and Iraq, and you see continued sectarian governments, and you see a divided nation that just isn't coming together. So I'm wondering how we can expect that to happen in Syria when you have about 20% of the FSA comprised of al-Nusra Front, which we agree is a terrorist organization, has a vested interest in continuing conflict for decades.
Dylan, let us pick it up, and I appreciate your call. Josh Landis, how about it? Let's say, I mean, it sounds cynical. I mean, you almost portray it as though the Obama administration is supporting these talks as a way to bide time and cover their hinder while they run out the clock on this. We see all the suffering out there. It's almost too horrible to think of it that way. Certainly, John Kerry wouldn't put it that way. But if it ends up in Russian hands, yeah. Dylan is asking, where does it go? Noah Bonzi says, that means you're going to have endless recruiting for jihadis, ISIS, and all the rest, and we just go deeper down that terrible road.
You know, that's the big question, is what's better for America? Is it better to have Assad win, destroy Nusra and ISIS, occupy Syria again, and try to hold down his population as a dictator? America's general attitude is no. We don't want dictatorship in the Middle East. We're going to support democracy, and we want regime change in order to do it. And that's what we've done. We've done it in Iraq. We've supported regime change in Libya, Yemen, and Syria. And in each case, we have created a failed state, chaos, and al-Qaeda has expanded. And now we've got ISIS expanding. Why? Because there's nothing to resist them. And there are two arguments. One is, well, you have to continue down this road. We're just halfway through it. And we should destroy Assad, the central state in Syria, and let these militias, of which there are 1,500, according to the CIA, just take over Syria in the hopes that al-Qaeda and ISIS will go away somehow once Assad is gone. And they'll say, well, the job is done, we'll leave.
We got that. But American attitudes may be changing. Noah says, go the way you're imagining, and you still have the Islamic State there.
Yes, you
still
do.
Have the jihadis.
You have a repressive regime is what you have. And America doesn't want to do that because, it's against our interest to support.
Yeah, but let's say people
oppression.
Get over that. We're learning as we go here, and it's painful. But even if with the oppressive regime, you think they can – you think then ISIS goes away? You think al-Qaeda goes away?
You know – Syria has been under an oppressive regime for many decades, and there was no al-Qaeda. Saddam Hussein ruled Iraq.
Yeah, but there's the tear in the fabric right there. If you're willing to accept all that, things have changed, right?
You're right, Tom. It's a terrible choice. This is a Hobbesian choice. America would like to impose democracy and make everybody happy and have economic growth. The thing is, America has failed to do that in any of the four states that it's plunged into, destroyed the state, and said we're going to make a better place in Libya or Yemen or whatever it is, and it's failed. So we can't solve this. If the Russians want to try to solve it, let them do it.
We may
because
be
America, America's not going to do it.
This On Point podcast is made possible by Squarespace. If you have a passion that you obsess over, if it keeps you up at night, if you live for it, you should show it off. With easy-to-use tools and templates, Squarespace websites help you capture every detail of what drives you. Because if it's worth the effort, it's worth showing to the world. Start your free trial today at squarespace.com. When you're ready to purchase, use the one-word offer code ONPOINT to save 10%. You should. Squarespace.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We are talking about the talks in Geneva launched to negotiate or attempt to an end to Syria's civil war. Almost nobody thinks they have a chance, but they are a good window through which to look at what is going on in Syria. Noah Bonzi is with us from Geneva. He's senior Syria analyst for the International Crisis Group. Joshua Landis is with us from the University of Oklahoma and the Center for Middle East Studies. He's director there. You can join us this hour. How does this war end? What outcome should the U.S. hope for? If this war doesn't end, then what? Does ISIS roll on? Does Europe keep getting flooded? What's your question on the bloodbath in Syria, on the players, their interests, the way forward? Behind all of this talk about geopolitics and interests, remember the suffering. It's just been incredible, gone on and on. Got a little bit of UN aid into Madaya, one of these Syrian cities under siege a couple of weeks ago. Last week, a Syrian doctor there told CNN the aid wasn't enough, interpreted here by CNN.
In the past 10 days since the arrival of relief supplies, the doctor says there have been 10 deaths. Scores of people have arrived at the clinic unconscious. We have around 500 sick people in the town that need hospital treatment.
And of course, that flow out just goes on and on. Even now in winter, BBC here, James Reynolds, reporting on the Syrian migrants flooding found off the coast of the Greek island of Samos just a few days ago.
Italy's coast guards, called in by Greece, found the survivors at night.
Hold them.
They'd spent 24 desperate hours on their sinking ship. Nizad carried his child's body, hoping in vain that rescuers might be able to bring the infant back to life.
Opposition in Syria has demands right out of the gate to even sit down for these talks. Delivery of aid to besieged towns, lifting those seizures, the release of prisoners, an end to government bombing of civilians. Those are all tall orders till here's Farah Al-Attassi on Monday, member of the opposition High Negotiations Committee.
Lifting the suffering of the Syrian people should be the dominant fact right now. We cannot go into any negotiation with the regime. We cannot go unless these measurements that were actually mentioned in the Security Council should be implemented.
Noah Bonzi in Geneva, you say everybody's looking on here, the sort of powers behind the conversation. How do you see Russia imagining a future if the U.S. comes to accept the Assad regime, and now they've got the whole thing in their laps? Can they deal with the Islamic State? Can they take out all the opposition that's grown up there over so many years now? What do they do with that, Noah?
So I think this is the central question, not just for the Russians, but for the Iranians. Because it's true, they, along with the regime, are gaining ground right now. The problem they have, the long-term problem they have, and it's linked to a problem Joshua alluded to earlier, is that the regime itself doesn't have the manpower to retake and then control, as basically what would be treated as an occupying force, major chunks of Syria currently outside of its control. So regardless of how much short-term progress the Russians and Iranians are enabling the regime to make, if they're thinking long-term, they're still going to want to take into account the long-term costs of helping the regime occupy that territory, much of which is going to be continued to be inhabited by a very hostile population, a population that has not liked the collective punishment the regime has imposed upon it over the last several years. So in some ways, the equation that we're trying to solve in terms of resolving this war is, can the Russians and Iranians be convinced that given the long-term cost of helping keep the Assad regime in power, helping sustain Bashar Assad's rule, given those long-term costs, is there a preferable scenario in which they make some concessions that enable a negotiated transition that ends Assad rule and then would pave the way for the U.S., Saudi Arabia, other Gulf countries to help share the costs of beginning the long process of rebuilding Syria? For the moment, the Iranians and Russians both seem to prefer a military status quo as they seek to strengthen their position on the ground. And so we haven't yet got to the point where it seems they're really taking into account the long-term costs that will impose upon them.
I want to get into that scenario, but if we can just back up for a second first, Josh Landis. Noah says the big question here is whether Saudi Arabia comes in heavy itself, pedal to the metal, sophisticated weaponry, lots of money, really throws its weight behind the opposition to Assad and the opposition to Russia. Do you think that could change the equation? Where would that take this war?
I don't think this Saudi Arabia can do that. The rebels can't win with Russian air force behind the Syrian regime. It's very possible the Syrian regime can reconquer Syria, it seems to me. They do have a manpower problem. But their argument, the regime argument, is that as we begin to win, more and more people will see the writing on the wall and they will join us. We're in negotiations with many of the opposition militias and we're trying to bring them in from the cold. Now, we don't know if that's true or not, but the Assad regime is best positioned, in a sense, to take ISIS territory as America weakens ISIS. They still have a big center in Deir ez-Zor, which is the capital city of the entire eastern province. It has moving against ISIS on three different fronts, in the north and in the south and in the center area of Homs. So as ISIS becomes weaker, it's most likely that the Syrian regime will snatch that territory. The Americans are supporting the Kurds to move down, but the Kurds have no interest in taking tons of Arab territory. And so that's the – we don't know whether Assad can reconquer all of Syria. The Russians are confident he can. He's saying he can do it. But how does America stop him from doing it and Saudi Arabia stop him? And is it in the interest of the United States to stop him from retaking this territory? That's the real question, because this civil war – is perpetuated by the sponsor powers, all of them arming up their militias enough so that they can continue the civil war and keep them as an active player, but not enough so they can win it. And the Russians are in here to win. The United States is trying to decide now, do we want to stop them from winning and just throw in enough tow missiles and other stuff to make them sink in a quagmire? Or do we let them win? And the Saudis are big people in this, as you say, who do not want the Russians to win. And a lot of that depends on the United States. Do we convince the Saudis, you know, this is not the time to win Syria. We're not going to win this one. And better to cut your losses and stop this. Let the Assad rebuild. And it's, in a way, that's what we did in 2008 with Iran when the Green Revolution took place. We got behind the Green Revolution, but as soon as we saw it was going to fail, we backed away. We let Iran, the government, reassume. Some of these fights we can't win. It's not in our interest to win them right now. In the long run, we've got to encourage democracy, the end of an Assad dictatorship, and a better Middle East. But today, we are stuck in a situation where we've encouraged regime change, I think, too naively, and we've created chaos throughout the Middle East, which has spurned this refugee process, and we've got to find a way to stabilize the Middle East.
The irony is just so painful because, of course, that's exactly what the Assad regime has said for decades as they extended
and
their
Qaddafi
oppressive
said it.
Rule.
Qaddafi said, if you take me out, there's going to be refugees flowing into Europe and al-Qaeda and other people are going to take over Libya. We didn't believe him. We thought that we could create democracy and a good government in Libya. We were wrong.
But watching those dictatorships go on and on was no fun either. You know, Noah Bonzi,
it's a bad choice.
It is. There in Geneva, I mean, Saudi Arabia obviously doesn't care really about democracy at all here. There you get into another level, sort of the Saudi Sunnis versus the Iranian Shia. If this is a proxy war in that battle, are they willing to lose it? Do you think – you say this is the big question, whether the Geneva talks end up with Saudi Arabia trying to come in heavy here, not to let Russia and Iran and Assad have Syria. Josh Landis says they don't have the capacity to resist that. Do you think they might, Noah?
Well, they might try. I agree with Joshua that – assuming current or similar levels of U.S. support, the opposition's backers, regional backers, Saudi Arabia, Turkey, Qatar, cannot on their own defeat a regime backed by the Russian Air Force. I agree with that. Again, I think what we're all trying to find is a middle ground between total opposition victory, which is impossible at this point, and a total regime victory, which would really not be a regime victory so much as it would be the defeat of some opposition groups while an ongoing jihad continued, whether or not, you know, ISIS and Nusra controlled, Jabhat al-Nusra controlled territory, they would continue the fight. And that would go on, you know, indefinitely for as long as we can foresee. I think getting to the point where Russians and Iranians are willing to consider, can we get them to the point where they are willing to accept less than continued Assad rule indefinitely over as much of Syria as possible? Or is that something they're willing to go all the way to provide the human and air power necessary to enable? It gets back to the central question of Geneva. The U.S. is hoping that that is the case. We just really don't know yet. But I agree with Joshua that the answer to this is not going to be in the Saudis or Turks or Qatari hands alone. It is beyond their means.
The Saudis haven't exactly looked like military geniuses in Yemen. That's looked fairly ham-handed there, though. You know, don't want to throw stones here. Noah, what about the future of ISIS and the Islamic State, given different possible outcomes here? Josh suggests that if Assad and the Russians roll on and they'll take more territory, reconquer his word, suggesting we'll take more back from the Islamic State. You said earlier Assad and Russians are the greatest recruiting tool for jihadis. Given different possible outcomes here, what are the ramifications or implications for the future of ISIS?
So I agree with Joshua that the regime with Russian support can probably continue to gain some territory back from ISIS. But the cost of that, in terms of the number of jihadi recruits that creates, both within these areas, because even if they're supplanting ISIS control, it's still going to be extremely difficult to stabilize these areas, to hold them. You'll still have sleeper cells and what have you. But also jihadi recruitment worldwide that will receive a further boost from the sight of Iranian-backed, Hezbollah-backed regime forces, widely hated throughout the Sunni world, taking territory inhabited mostly by Sunni Arab Muslims, in a scenario that in which there is at least perceived American complicity allowing this to happen. This, in many eyes, will simply confirm what jihadi groups have been desperately trying to argue to a Sunni audience for years, which is that the entire international system is stacked against you, and you need to join us in a war to overthrow it, a total war to overthrow it. This is what al-Qaeda and ISIS in different ways have been advocating for a long time. And even if the regime and the Russians are able to take some territory, I would strongly argue that overall that scenario is working to the advantage of jihadi groups throughout the world, and it will only exacerbate that problem.
Alex in New Haven, Connecticut. Alex, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Thanks for taking my phone call. I'll be very quick. The reluctance of the Saudis or unwillingness to get boots on the ground seems to me to be a big issue. If we wait another year, 2 years for the Saudis to get their act together and there's another attack in Paris or San Bernardino, isn't the reaction to be by the American public, especially with the GOP president, going to be that American troops have to have boots on the ground? Isn't it only a matter of time before that happens?
I appreciate your call, Alex. There's certainly a lot of talk about that on the Republican side of the presidential primary campaign. What about it, Josh Landis? You've got any number of Republican would-be presidential contenders already saying quite firmly that they'll go in heavy, including boots on the ground. If the U.S. itself gets engaged here, where would it throw its weight and what outcome?
Well, the leading Republican candidate, Cruz, right now, has come out very strongly against Obama policy and said regime change in the Middle East has failed. And he blamed Libya on Obama. He blamed, in fact, the Syrian crisis on Obama. He said we should not have overturned the dictators. So in a sense, he has gone against the entire neoconservative idea of bringing democracy to the Middle East. And he's saying, we've got to support our dictators.
But he didn't say don't get involved militarily. He's the guy who said turn the desert to glass.
Yeah, he wants to kill ISIS.
He wants
to turn ISIS's desert to glass, but he does not want regime change in Damascus. And that's the big difference. So even the Republicans have abandoned the notion of trying to build a democracy and help the rebels win because they fear that rebels winning and taking Damascus will put al-Qaeda and ISIS at the heart of another state in the Middle East. And that fear is not far-fetched. This is – so the Republicans don't hold out a lot of hope for the Syrian rebels and even – and Trump – we know that Trump said he sort of admired Russia. So it is the best hope for the Syrian rebels is if Clinton wins because she said she was for no-fly zones for the rebels. But that was before Russia landed in Syria with an air force. I don't think she's going to be interested in taking on the Russians in Syria. Syria is just not that valuable to the United States or to the presidency, Clinton presidency. She's got many other things she wants to get done, not fighting Russia in Syria. So in that sense, it's very hard to see a scenario that is going to really destroy the Russian effort, turn out Assad, and create some nation-building process. What you can see is either a resistance against the Russia, which will perpetuate the civil war and cause real chaos, and in a sense – from American point of view, from American interests, it does make a certain amount of sense just to let the Russians try to win this for Assad, destroy ISIS and Nusra, and see if they can do it because we don't have what it takes to make our vision come true and a democracy in Syria.
We'll see where that argument goes as Geneva rolls forward or doesn't as the suffering goes on in Syria. Beyond all the geopolitics, I'm just thinking of all of those people, those families, those prisoners, those besieged Syrians, those at sea and wandering toward Europe. This is not just a chessboard. It's flesh and blood, and the cost has been unbelievably high. Grateful to the two of you for being with us today. Joshua Landis at the University of Oklahoma Center for Middle East Studies. Thank you for joining us, Josh.
Pleasure. Thank you, Tom.
Noah Bonzi with the International Crisis Group with us today from Geneva. Thank you, Noah.
It's a pleasure, Tom.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.